A number of years ago, I spent a lot of time in the north of Spain, in the Basque Country, which straddles France and Spain, and Bilbao and San Sebastian. And those people are a proud people. They went through a lot in sort of 1937, hence Picasso's Guernica. They were bombed by the Franco regime, the fascist regime, in 1937, and there was an exodus. And of all places, for a lot of the people to land, Boise, Idaho, was not the place that you would think it, where they would go. I'm Hugh Acheson. This is The Passenger from iHeartRadio. People ask me all the time, because I travel a lot for work and being a chef and doing all these things, you know, what's that list of places to go in this city, in that city? Where's a good coffee shop? What's a good museum? So I've always doodled and created lists, and this show is dedicated to that idea, immersing yourself in that culture and finding out in a quick couple-day trip what's intriguing about that place and what resounds and where are they at and what we think about the future of that place as a visitor, as a passenger. And so this show's about that, where we'll talk about that place. Later in this episode, I'll talk to Dave Yasuda of Snake River Farms, and I'll get feedback on what I've done and where I should have gone. It's a travel show. My name's Hugh Acheson. Let's do this. So the Basque immigration in Boise started in the 1800s, really then ramped up after 1937 and the bombings of Guernica, when the Basques decided to leave. A lot of them decided to have an exodus from their land. And they went to, in immigration ways, they're sort of brought to, because of their skill sets in sort of mountainous farming and mountainous sheep herding, they were brought to Boise. And so Boise has a Basque cultural center. It's got a number of Basque restaurants. It's got Bar Guernica and Lika Ona. It's got a very famous oak tree from a sapling of an oak that was symbolic of the Oak of Guernica, and it was thought to be brought from that actual tree, which is this amazing tree in the original Guernica. So in the middle of nowhere in Idaho exists this cultural repository of an exodus of people under strife who came to the land of potatoes. For years, I've been going to Boise because I cook at a festival called Tree Fort, which I'll get to in a little bit. Tree Fort's amazing. But Boise is amazing. And you fly into it, and usually I go from Atlanta to Salt Lake City on Delta, and then I hub on Delta from Salt Lake to Boise. Land, I get picked up by a friend, I go to a hotel. There are a number of great hotels. There's a beautiful sort of redone motel called the Hotel Modern that's awesome. It's got a beautiful bar and restaurant in it. Then I usually go, and hopefully I've rented a car, because I go out and find arguably the best patisserie pastry shop in America is in a strip mall in Boise, Idaho, called Janjou Pastry. And it is phenomenal pastry work, like really high-end, crazy interesting work, beautiful quiches and laminated pastries and croissants and cookies and really, really fine pastry work, nominated for Beard Awards, but literally in a strip mall outside of Boise. Boise's got is a repository of music and amazing things to do. It's got a number of good museums and things like that. It's got an old Idaho penitentiary that's really good. The Boise Farmers Market's totally cool. Where else do you find the world's largest potato? I did go on a search for something I never find, which is the rocket, Marvin's rocket from Looney Tunes. Marvin was the crazy Martian, Marvin the Martian, and he had his little Iridium Q-36 space modulator gun, and he was dressed in Roman garb. And he was a little guy, and he had this crazy rocket. Evidently, the rocket's there somewhere. There's a replica of it, but I couldn't find it. There is the Idaho Candy Store with the famous Idaho Spud. It is a chocolate, coconut, and marshmallow candy bar that will immediately strip all of the covering off your teeth because it is saccharine sweet. There's a giant Abe Lincoln. I did find that. Yeah, there is amazing coffee there and really a growing amount of really good food. I go to probably twice a day when I'm there. I go to a place called Slow by Slow Coffee, which is an exquisite, really, really good focused coffee shop. Two different espressos at play every day. You get to choose which espresso you want. Amazing pour over program, really good beans, amazing graphic design, and really cool place. Outside of town is the World Center for the Birds of Prey, which is really cool if you're into things like, I like, what are they called? Kestrels, are the little murderous little wonderful birds, to lean to that. When we talk about potatoes, they are big there, but it is not a town fully run by Simplot. There's lots of different agrarianism happening right around the corner in the rural landscape of Idaho. There's a very large beef company called AgriBeef, which has Snake River Farms, which actually I've done some work for in the past, and actually Davey Sudo works for, who we'll talk to later. So food-wise in Boise, there is a fair bit. There's an amazing restaurant called Petit Four, Little Four, or Petit Four, like the little gift you get from the kitchen. Tiny little place doing really French-focused stuff. There's another restaurant called Fork that was really good. There's lots of bars and arcades that I really like. There's a space bar arcade that's great. It's old pinball machines and old vintage video games. It's a lot of fun to go into. I went to an amazing bar called Prost, P-R-O-S-T, exclamation mark. Great selection of wonderful beers, really cool and great menu of like brats and, different wurst and all that sort of stuff that's really interesting. And there's a lot of that sort of European sort of thing going on in Idaho and centered in Boise that's really interesting. There's a great club, though, called Neuralux, which is a kind of a punk rock club that's really, really great place to go. There's a place called Whiskey Bar that's a fun place. Tom Greeny's, I went there. But yeah, 10th Street Station is a great little dive bar as well. There's the Bass Cultural Center, and the Bass Cultural Center has a bar within it, which kind of feels like you're at a... you could be playing bingo at any time with a lot of older folk, which, hey, that's my speed. So that's good. The food scene there is growing. I think it's getting better and better, and we're seeing a lot of things happening. But Jeanjou is probably the apex of what we're talking about when it comes to great food. But then there's Wild Root Cafe. There was an amazing restaurant called State and Lemp that's moved on. There is Bar Guernica, which is one of the Basque bars and right around the corner from the Cultural Center, which is an amazingly interesting little spot. I wouldn't say when the Basque Exodus happened that Boise fully embraced meticulous Basque technique in food, because the Basque area in Spain is known for being really the birthplace of modern gastronomy in a lot of ways, and molecular gastronomy and things like that. They didn't grab onto that as much. But I think there's a lot of things going on in the world of food there that are going to be really good. Let's go to Treefort and talk about the SIP Festival, which is in sort of early spring, late winter. This year it's in late March. Oftentimes it's in April. It's an arts festival. It's got tech stuff. It's got a ton of music. It's got food and beer elements to it as well. So I go there and cook with friends out there. But, you know, but the festival is music-wise, is amazing. A couple of years ago, I saw Touche Amore in front of probably 50 people, which is an amazing punk band from L.A. I saw Alves, A-L-V-V-A-Y-S, from Toronto, who is an amazing band, Angel Olsen, the Meat Puppets, the Coat Hangers, Grouper, Kishibashi, who's from Athens, Georgia, Lower Dens, Mac DeMarco, And then, obviously, one of the really homegrown bands of Boise, and probably the biggest band out of Boise ever, which is Built to Spill. And that's Doug Marsh's amazing guitar work and songwriting. So Treefort is an amazing festival because you get to wander around. And I love festivals, and I love food festivals. And this is a good remark for every festival planner out there. I find the best festivals are ones where you get around on foot, where it's very pedestrian-based. They happen in a lot of different venues. There's a lot of different things going on at once. And Treefort uses about 15 different venues to do that. So at any given time, there's, you know, 15 shows going on that you can wander around and see. They're pretty easy to get into. Some of them are really packed. Some of them are main stage things that are very crowded, but they're still very accessible. And just that wandering around and that act of being immersed in an entire city that's into an entire festival is really interesting. So it really is a festival that I think, after being to a gazillion festivals in the United States, is probably one of the best. Like, to me, it's just top three type of places. During Treefort, and a lot of different venues are used, including the El Cora Shrine, which is a Shriners club, two stories, sort of restaurant-y, more bar, and then main venue downstairs where the shows go on. And it is the oddest place to see a show. That's wonderful because all these old Shriners are selling you tokens for buying drinks because you have to pay in tokens. And so they're all wandering around in their crazy hats. There's a whole little stall selling sort of Shriner memorabilia. So I have a Shriners Convention 1978 belt buckle from Toronto that I bought there. I bought a couple of little hats just in case I ever want to have a new hobby. Because the Shriners do a lot of great things, but in this venue, it's totally amazing juxtaposed. It's kind of like going to a veterans hall or something like that. And it changes the whole perspective on what it is. It kind of makes it a lot more fun. So go to a show at El Cora Shrine during Treefort. You will not be disappointed. And I've seen a lot of shows there, and it's actually a really good venue for sound. Sound comes out really well. There's some places when they've got music festivals going on and they plunk down different bands in different venues that aren't meant for music, that the sound just is horrible. But the sound at El Cora Shrine is really good, and it's just another aspect of Boise that I find really idiosyncratic and interesting and something to show off. The motto of Boise is energy, peril, and success. The inhabitants are called Boiseans. And let's talk about the pronunciation of Boise, because it's not Boise, like noisy. It's Boise. Boise. And they even have that on their website and on t-shirts and things like that. So this is a place that's got, you know, great small breweries happening. It's got great food. It's got a university culture. It's got the Blue Field of Boise State, which is a smaller university that's got an amazing football program, and they're on national TV a lot because they have that really bright blue field. The weather there in the summer is beautifully warm. In the winter, it's beautifully snowy, and in between, it's always beautiful. So it's just a really amazing city to go to. And it's the type of place that you can go to and have a urban environment, and 10 minutes later, you are in such pristine wilderness and rural areas and along rivers and streams that there's no excuse not to experience something like that. I'm Hugh Atchison, and this is The Passenger. When we come back, we'll talk about immigration, past and present, and we'll get a local's take on Boise with Dave Yasuda of Snake River Farms. This is The Passenger from iHeartRadio. So staying in Boise, I've stayed at the Grove Hotel, which is a large and good, luxurious, simple in a lot of ways, still reasonable. I mean, that's the other thing about going to a place in a city like Boise is it's extraordinarily reasonable to get there, to fly there, at least where I am in Atlanta, and from the other coast would be very reasonable. The airport is probably 10, 15 minutes away from downtown, so it's one of those places that's really easy to get to. The worst is flying into a town and the airport's like 2 hours away from where you actually need to be, and then you have to jump in a taxi and like take the equivalent of another flight to get to your hotel. You're probably going to have to hub still. But then their hotel rate, you know, the fanciest hotel in the whole city is going to run you well under $200. The Grove Hotel is really good. I've also stayed at the very schmancy Hampton Inn. I've stayed at the Hyatt Place downtown. Those are all just national chains and things like that, but they are great. And it really is such a pedestrian town, and you can rent a bike, you can wander on foot, and really traverse the downtown's really going to be about 12 blocks. And within that confines is going to be the capital. If you want to get out of town or you want to drive outside of town to go to different restaurants or Jeanju, that pastry shop that I love, then you're going to have to rent a car or jump in an Uber or something like that. So back to the Basque history, it's really interesting that to me that the largest population of Basque people outside of Spain and France is in Idaho, in the capital of Idaho. I was kind of flummoxed and blown away when I heard that. But they originally came and they were often tried to be put to work in mining camps and things like that. And but they really found their home in ranching and shepherding and sheep herding, and because that's what they did back home. And so that transfer of skill set was really interesting. But to sort of preserve their cultural heritage, starting in the 1800s, they also opened up a lot of Basque hotels and boarding houses, and just to sort of welcome other Basque people. And so there became this sort of three block radius in downtown Boise that was thoroughly Basque. And it still is. And there's a full adoration of that culture there. Of immigrants. And when we talk about immigrants in Boise and in Idaho overall, it's kind of really interesting that they welcomed that way back when for such a long time. But now it's kind of front and center in another way, in another version of immigrants coming from California. And as an exodus of people from California are moving because of vast amounts of population growth and traffic and cost of living, a lot of people have found themselves in Boise. And there's kind of a pushback right now that's a little weird against that sort of migration of people from California. So it's really interesting, on the one hand, that you've got this largest immigrant community in the Basques, and now you have another moving immigrant community of Americans from California moving in that are kind of being pushed back against. So there's a little bit of a story and a newsworthiness to that. The Basque and the Museum and Cultural Center, they have a yearly festival as well called Jaialdi. I'm really bad with the Basque pronunciation. Jaialdi. And that brings together people and Basque people from all over the world to celebrate the culture of the Basque people, food, traditional games, dancing, and music. And as you know, if you've ever been to the Basque region of Spain, those things are really prized. And the cider culture and pink sauce and all the small plate stuff is really a reverential thing within the Basque community. And it's just, oddly enough, we see it as well in Idaho. It's funny how you learn history. I was watching an episode of Homeland the other day, and a compromised Russian spy was being interviewed or talked to by, one of the main characters. And They're near the Snake River, and they're looking at the Snake River, and the Russian said, "Do you know why they call it the Snake River?" And he sort of meandered his hand in a sort of motion like a snake. And he said that the Indians, when confronted by the white settlers had asked, "What's the name of the river?" And the Indians made a motion like that. And obviously the white people thought it was a snake, so they called it the Snake River. But what they really meant was that that was fish, and there was an abundance of fish in this river, and that's what they loved about it. So they called it the Fish River. Well, the Snake River stuck. There's so many things that stick when it comes to history. There's another saying in Boise, see how I said that? Is les bois, the woods in French. And that's kind of the rallying cry of Boise. And it's a credit to Captain Bonneville of the U.S. Army. After trekking for weeks through dry and rough terrain, his exploration party reached an overlook with a view of the Boise River Valley. The place where they stood is called Bonneville Point, located on the Oregon Trail east of the city. According to the story, a French-speaking guide, overwhelmed by the sight of the verdant river, yelled, "Les bois! Les bois!" And the name stuck. Boise, les bois. So the name seems to have derived from there, but, you know, there's a lot of history of Canadian fur trappers around there, which, again, goes the French derivation of the name. But, again, it's Boise. When we look at a map of Boise, you know, you're in the mountains. You're in Idaho. And the Snake River is just sort of south of you. And every time I go out there, I'm not really a big fisher person, but I do find myself fly fishing because the friend that I hang out with out there is a guy named Dave Ucito, who we'll talk to later. He's got a brother-in-law who's a very good fly fishing guide. And so he takes us out and we kind of cast things into the river and hope for the best. And sometimes I've caught big trout. And sometimes not, but that doesn't matter. Sometimes fly fishing is just more philosophical and peaceful than it is productive in the way of, you know, it's catch and release anyhow. It's not like I'm actually going to cook the thing. But it's an amazing thing to stand in a cold river and waders and just sort of pensively and technically try and land a fish and coax them onto that hook and bring it up. And it's amazing. So, you know, we've got this city that's growing, and it's got a lot of things going for it. I think the education system and the university there is growing like mad, and that's good. I think the cost of living is going up, but I think it's still a good time to be there. And again, the cost of going there is really just not that expensive. You know, Boise State plays in the Albertson Stadium with that blue field. Those are the Broncos. You should go to a game. I went to a game. It was great. It was against Air Force. They won. I think they always win at home. And they're always on TV because of the blue field. Because everybody wants to see a blue field. I think I may have go into sort of epileptic shock with the blue field watching it on TV. It's very blue. So obviously, you know, I miss a lot, and I'm visiting places for a brief period of time. I'm not a resident, and so I call on people. And this week, I'm going to call on Dave Ucito, who's lived in Boise a long time. He does marketing for a very large and successful, amazing American Kobe beef company called Snake River Farms, which is the most delectable beef, but we're not selling that, so you can buy it if you want. Now I've got on the line, giggling in the background, is Dave Ucito. And Dave lives in Boise. Dave, tell the world what you do in Boise.
Hi, Hugh. I work for a company called Snake River Farms. It's American Wagyu beef. That's my regular job. But then I also work as the director of Food Fort, which is the food part of the Treefort Music Festival.
Which I have participated in many times. So Dave and I, over the years, through his affiliation with Snake River Farms, which is a beef farm that we absolutely adore, and with Treefort, have become very good friends over the years. Dave, let's talk about Boise. What's cool in Boise these days?
You know, Boise at its core, Hugh, is an outdoors town. The Boise River runs right through the middle of it. There's my office sits there. I see people pulling fish out of there. So there's also, we're in close proximity to river rafting, to mountain biking, to skiing, to snowboarding, to trail running. So that's kind of the thing that I think brings people in. But if you look online, we're always at named like 10 best city for livability, for, you know, they've said, you know, we're like the next culinary scene. I think that was in Vogue magazine last year or something. So a lot of people are pointing to us. And I think that some of those accolades are maybe not deserved, but you know, you've been here. I think what's cool, it's a friendly group of people. You know, it's a very welcoming city. It's clean. It's, you know, easy to get around. You know, it seems like everyone has cars, but you don't really need one here. I walk to work.
It's really pedestrian as a city, I find.
Yeah.
And that's because it's the right size. You know, so let's talk about what's happening in food there right now. And, you know, I talked about Steak and Limp, which was there for a while, is no longer there. I talked about, you know, Petit Four. I talked about Jean Jus Bakery, which is so amazing, patisserie. What are your top three go-to restaurants these days?
So I'm going to come back to the answer real quick. I just want to say the State and Limp people, so that's Chef Chris Camori and Ramey McManus, they are in the process of reopening under the name Kin, K-I-N. And that's a restaurant. Actually, it'll be open probably when you come back for Tree Fort, Hugh. I think they're going to continue that vision of, you know, maybe a really high-end tasting menu. But then at the same time, they're going to have a bar and they're going to have things available for, you know, people who are just cruising in. So I haven't even tried that, but that's on my top of my list to go in there. As far as things that I do on kind of a regular basis, I'm somewhat of a creature of a habit. I like beer a lot. I actually bourbon, as you know, because we've had some bourbon together. But there's a restaurant that's kind of the venerable old place. It's called Bitter Creek Ale House. And I like Bitter Creek because they have a great selection of beer. I usually cruise in. I know the people that are there and, you know, sit at the bar. And the food is, you know, pub food, but it's like a really great pub food. They have things like the focaccia beef au jus that's actually they may have changed it. I don't think they serve it on focaccia anymore, but it's really great beef. You know, dip it in the delicious au jus. They hand cut their fries. It's awesome. Other places that I really like in town are Petit Four. I know you mentioned that. Sarah Kelly and her husband Dave run that. And it's French inspired. Again, I guess I'm not a planner. I like to just cruise in at the weird times and maybe see if I can get a seat at the bar or something. But Sarah does a great job. Tech tip, if you get there for happy hour, they almost always have oysters. They're $2, half price champagne and things like that. And I'm a sucker for a good deal also. There are other places I go to, too. One of the places right in my neighborhood is a Stagecoach. And I'm not sure if I've taken you there, but that's an old
school. Oh, I've passed by it. It's got awesome sign. Yeah. It's an old steakhouse sort of place, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been there since 1959.
I have not been there. I do want to go there. Those historic steakhouses of the West are so cool to me.
Yeah, and it's like that. You know, it's like the red vinyl banquettes, and you know, it's like it's a great place. And they actually closed down for a short amount of time. And then the people that worked at the restaurant bought it and they brought it back. And, you know, they've updated it slightly, but it's still at its core, you know, a place you get a good steak. They do a great fried chicken. So those are some places to check out in Boise.
Okay, so we've gone down this road before, but pardon my French, but what the fuck is up with steak fingers?
So it's finger steaks is what we like to call them here, Hugh. They say that, there's a little bit of controversy. Everyone claims to have invented them.
And why? I've never had a good one. These are
deep fried beef.
Yeah, it's like battered, deep fried, finger shaped pieces of beef
served with cocktail sauce.
Was somebody just wanting a shrimp cocktail, and it was like, I killed a cow, and we can do this. It is the strangest traditional food I think I've seen in the West. I mean, I just, and I don't really get it, but I mean, I still have this because I'm a chef. I just have this want to like recreate it to be amazing. But I want that to be like, you know, somebody else catching that fire and doing it for me.
Well, I've seen it in restaurants and someone will use like a tempura batter or they'll try to do panko or different things. And, you know, there was this place that is now like a topless bar called the Torch. But back in the day, it was the place to go for finger steaks. And I wish they were still open because I would take you there.
Did they have boobies and finger steaks at the same time?
No, I don't think there was ever that crossover.
Okay, good, because that is an archaic Prohibition-era law in Idaho. deep-fried steak and naked women do not mix. And then you took me to, once you picked me up at the airport, and we went for a drink at Gil's Canine Bar. Tell me about that place.
Well, I'm going to get in trouble for talking about this. This is like telling someone about your fishing hole, right? You know, but it's a great place. It's been there for as long as I can remember. And the owner really, I mean, we didn't eat there, but they always have, you know, much elevated food. I mean, I think they have like a 2-for-1 burger thing on Thursday, but the burgers are delicious. And, you know, they've got, you know, big half-pound patties, et cetera. But they like bourbon. And in this state, we don't get a lot of the really premium liquor. And, you know, the more bourbon has caught on, it's like that everything's on allocation. But rather than, you know, do something crazy or overprice that, there's just almost always a really great selection of bourbons there and at a reasonable price. You know, you'll see all the regular things, you know, but they'll mix it up. Like, you'll see a Weller 12. You'll see, you know, some of the nicer E.H. Taylors. But, I mean, and on up, anything you can think of. And a man's kind of comes down to your timing and how nice you are. I think you kind of have to prove that you're worthy of the purchase. But for the most part, it's a super friendly place, and it's a great place to get a whiskey.
Yeah, Boise always seems like a super friendly place overall. It's got one of the Mac Daddy amazing record stores called the Record Exchange right downtown that seems to be really popular during Treefort, and I shop for records there when I'm in town because I love collecting vinyl. What's the history of the Record Exchange? Didn't they start Record Store Day?
Yeah, they did. Mike Bunnell and his wife, Jill, Mike is one of the founders of Record Store Day. And, you know, you and I have been in this record stuff long enough to know just not that long ago when vinyl was not a thing and Mike stuck through it. They, for some reason, all the big record stores bypassed Boise, you know, so like Tower Records and some of those places that are actually, I guess, out of business now. But Mike and Jill just stuck it out. And they, you know, when people were buying CDs, they did the CD thing. But they've always sat on this huge inventory of amazing vinyl. And now I'm sorry, I'm not thinking it's a coalition of independent record stores, and Mike has been president.
Yeah, it's all the Record Store Day coalition, and they do a really good job, and it's awesome. But the record store is phenomenally cool and really fun. Tell me about Treefort, because Treefort's coming up at least this year, but it's always in the sort of March, April timeframe, correct?
It is. It's scheduled right after South by Southwest. So the idea originally was when artists were leaving South by Southwest, they're heading, you know, back home or whatever, they can come check out Boise. And this year it's March 25th through 29th. So it runs Wednesday through Thursday. It's possibly the best deal on a music festival you can imagine. The tickets slowly go up. Right now for $210, you could see every show, hit every venue, you know, from Wednesday to Sunday.
And every show would be like 250 shows. I mean, it's insane how many things are going on at once during the day because there's so many different venues.
That's what's really cool about it. I think that, you know, from a local's perspective, what I've learned to do is you kind of just stay in a general vicinity. And the thing that's crazy about the festival, you know, I have friends all over the country. They want to come and they go, well, so tell me about it. You know, what kind of music do they play? And it's one of those few festivals that literally any kind of music you want is there. I mean, everything from Americana to, you know, alt rock to, you know, jazz to you name it, it's there. EMD, it's kind of crazy. And it's part of the fun. And shows run everywhere. You can walk down the street in places that are unlikely venues, there's probably music playing.
Yeah, it's always struck me as really interesting in using a lot of sort of disparate places, disparate venues, and sort of coalescing them into this festival each year. And that's what kind of makes it intimate and really cool. So in Boise, you know, obviously we've read nationally about a little bit of sort of, I don't know, like issues with people from California moving there and some sort of. So is that a real issue? Is that something that people are talking about? Because yeah. It's a city of a certain size that's an ideal in a lot of ways, and some people don't want their ideal impinged upon by others, outsiders. But at the same time, the people are saying that this is a town that lays a lot of its history within the Basque population there of immigrants, and you know, in a large way is built to its current state by a huge amount of, you know, people from that area of the world coming over.
Yeah, so you know I grew up around here. Then you know I lived in all around the coast, San Francisco, L.A., Seattle, and kind of saw things happening there. And then when I got back, it was kind of during that sweet spot when you know it was housing was super affordable. You know, when you compare it to the rest of the world, we're still you know more affordable than those places. But you know, a person working an hourly wage, you know, could buy a house here in a nice location. And that part of it has gone away. And I think that's where you get a lot of the, you know, the local pushback on people coming in. Because what happens is people might get a good job here. You know, they're coming from a big market. They sell their house. They don't really shop the market. I've got a weekend and they pay full cash for, you know, a house here. And it keeps driving the prices up. For homeowners, I mean, I count myself in there. I'm fortunate to have a nice place and the value has skyrocketed. But you know, if I want to stay in Boise to sell it, doesn't make any sense. So, I mean, that does create, people are talking about that, and you hear that more and more.
I mean, the only thing I would say to those people is that's everywhere these days. You know, it's in Athens, Georgia, it's in Atlanta, it's in, you know, Cleveland. It's, you know, it's like if you sell your house in San Francisco for $1.6 million and you go to a city that the fanciest house in the world there is $600,000, you're kind of winning in some way. You know, and good for you, but and hopefully you just spend a lot of money in the local economy as you do it and support good restaurants. So that's the logic that I always use on those things. But Dave, Boise is an amazing place, and I think the future of it's really bright, and it's due to locals like you who make it alive. So,
well, thanks, man.
You know, in every direction, you can go somewhere in Boise and see amazing, beautiful wilderness and nature. So what's the closest, like, skiing place?
There's a place called Bogus Basin that's about 40 minutes up the hill.
Okay.
I was just there yesterday. I mean, so here's a Boise story for you. I got up. I was up there at 9 o'clock. I skied till noon. I came back, cleaned the house, and I went for a mountain bike ride. So it's like, if you're an outdoors person, it's all here. But Bogus is right up the hill, and I think they're running their ski pass deal now. It's like a full season pass. I think it's like $290 or something. So, and they have night skiing. You can go up skiing after work, and they have these lights that are on the runs. And so that's a very Boise thing is the close ski areas. Of course, we also have Sun Valley. That's about 2.5 hours away, world-class ski resort and a great place called Brundage that's in McCall. Also around there's a place called Tamarack. So, and a lot of the kids I work with here, they love Tamarack. It's close enough they can go up for the day.
Yeah. No, it's just amazing abundance of different things to do, but yet the urban environment is really exciting to me now there, and it's really lively. Well, Dave, thanks a lot, and everybody go out to Boise and wave at Dave. You'll see him.
All right. Thanks, Hugh. Appreciate the time.
I'm Hugh Atchison. You're listening to The Passenger from iHeartRadio. We'll be back after this quick break. I'm Hugh Atchison. This is The Passenger. One good way to prepare for a trip beyond packing your suitcase is through media. And for some recommendations, I'm going to hand it over to Jordan Runtog. He's a former music editor of People Magazine at VH1.com and regular contributor at Rolling Stone and Entertainment Weekly. Runtog is also co-host of the podcast Rivals, which is out now from iHeartRadio. If you're interested in music industry beef, definitely check that out.
When in Boise, you gotta play the hometown heroes, loud if possible. Built to Spill are arguably Boise's favorite musical sons. And why not? Songs like Twin Falls and Carry the Zero are amazing. But I wanted to shine some light on another band with local connections. Yes, I'm talking about Paul Revere and the Raiders. You may know them as that somewhat goofy novelty group that dressed up in full Revolutionary War regalia back in the 60s, but I'll tell you what, these guys rocked. Hard. They were founded by a guy named Paul Revere Dick. Yes, that was his real name. He ran some restaurants in the Boise area, and one day while picking up some hamburger buns, he met a young bakery worker named Mark Lindsay. This guy Mark sang a bit, and together they decided to create a group. First, they went with the name The Downbeats, but they decided that, shocker, that name was a little too downbeat. So they embraced Paul's historical moniker. In 1961, they released the full-throttle instrumental Likes Long Hair, which broke the top 40 on the national chart, a fairly uncommon occurrence for a Boise area band at the time. And that paved the way for the fame and fortune to come with hits like Kicks and Hungry. If you do end up heading to the Treefort Music Festival, like Hugh mentioned earlier, you'll be able to catch one of my favorite local Boise bands, Hillfolk Noir. In case that name isn't evocative enough for you, dig this description by fellow local musician John Doe. If John Steinbeck owned a speakeasy, Hillfolk Noir would be the house band. Pretty great, right? I've also heard them described as Johnny Cash on Robitussin. Hillfolk Noir are a trio fronted by Travis Ward, and they play old-school Depression-era hillbilly instruments like washboard, guitar, musical saw, upright bass, and even an old suitcase for percussion. But they play these traditional instruments in an extremely non-traditional way. They call their sound Junker Dash, a blend of folk, bluegrass, punk, string band blues, and other diverse musical influences. The band recommend pairing this sonic stew with bourbon and dancing, always a recipe for a good time. Maybe the best example of their whole Oh Brother Where Art Thou meets Hot Topic vibe is the track North Idaho Zombie Rag. Yes, you heard that right. It opens with a furiously strummed, distorted banjo feedback, which I have to admit was a first for my ears. It's truly indescribable, so give it a spin and try to check them out next time you're in town.
Last time I was in Boise, actually, second to last time I was in Boise, we were going to be flying out the next day. My friend Sam, who cooks with me, and we've been cooking there. And so we're going to miss one of the headlining acts, Built to Spill, who I've been a big fan of for many, many years, having seen them at the 40 Watt in Athens a couple of times and on the road in other places. And if you've ever heard Built to Spill, you should. It's just one of the seminal, to me, alternative bands of the last 25 years. And Doug Marsh, the lead singer and guitarist, has been just writing amazing songs for eons and eons, and isn't that band and a couple of others. But really, Built to Spill is his main one. But I remember they were supposed to play the next day. We're going to miss the show. We went to a bar in the afternoon to have a beer and go over some notes of other things we needed to do. And the bar was on the ground floor, and there are a couple floors above it in this older building in downtown Boise. I can't even remember the name of the bar. Simple place. And suddenly I hear bass drum coming through from upstairs, and I know the beat. And it's a song called The Plan, and it's a Built to Spill song. And my strange brain is connecting dots, and I'm figuring out, and we're having a beer underneath Built to Spill's practice space. So through a muffled area of a floor, basically I heard a whole concert of Built to Spill while playing pool and having a beer. So I felt like I had seen the show in a more intimate environment, albeit muffled by 6 inches of flooring between us with probably some insulation in between. You know, when you go down one of the main streets and you look up the Capitol, and it's just such an amazingly beautiful valley city. And then you're looking around at the mountains around you, and you just realize you're in a place that's just so amazingly interesting and so close to just this abundance of nature. And you go fishing, and you go hiking, and you go back into town, and you go out for a nice dinner and a beer. and you relax and you look outside the window and you breathe the clean air outside and you wander around the town and people are smiling and generally happy and quite athletic. And that's all good. And you realize you're in a place that not a lot of people get to. And they should, because it's easy.
You've been listening to The Passenger. This is a production of iHeartRadio, created by Hugh Acheson and Christopher Hasiotis. We're produced and edited by Mike Johns. Our researcher is Jesslyn Shields, and Christopher Hasiotis is our executive producer. Special thanks to Gabrielle Collins, Crystal Waters, and the rest of the crew. If you like The Passenger, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people like you find the show. If you're a local and you want to let me know what I missed and where I should go on my next visit, or if you've recently been a passenger like me and want to share your experience, hit me up on Instagram and Twitter at Hugh Acheson. Next time on The Passenger, we'll travel far away from far away to Newfoundland and to Fogo Island.
Culture is nothing more than a response to a place. So we wanted to put place and community back in the center of life.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, use the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks for listening.